Hello everyone. I'm back for another lecture and we are looking at the early Cold War. We're talking about the last element of the early Cold War, deterrence and forward presence. We're on slide 24. And really what we're talking about here is we're going to discuss nuclear weapons. Now here's some basic points that we need to cover first. Before World War II, the major countries in the world were referred to as great powers. That's how you signified a country was powerful, one of the most powerful countries in the world. After World War II, with the creation of atomic weapons and nuclear weapons, and we'll talk about the difference between those in just a bit, the United States and the Soviet Union came to be called superpowers. Because you had to differentiate between an old great power that had global military capability and a superpower that had nuclear weapons capability, that had the possibility, or I should say, the capability of destroying entire cities, of destroying entire nations in an afternoon. Right? So nuclear weapons were so significantly different from anything that had come before that you had to come up with a new term for them, and that was superpowers. So the question or the issue was that nuclear weapons were so significantly different that World War III, well, World War II, you all have a good picture of it, tanks, bombers, the devastation of the war. Estimates are 84 million people killed in a war that in Europe began in 1939, in Asia began in 1937, in China you could argue it began in 1931 when Japan took parts of China. So if you add up 1931 to 1945, you get roughly, by many estimates, about 84 million people killed. World War III, well, World War III might lead to 84 million casualties in a couple of hours. That's what we're talking about when we talk about nuclear weapons. In fact, the devastation, the capability of nuclear weapons was so great that people would say World War III was fought with nuclear weapons, World War IV was fought with sticks and stones. In that World War III, a nuclear war between the United States and the Soviet Union could be the end of civilization, the destruction of all civilization on the planet. The United States is gone, the Soviet Union is gone, the rest of the world is gone. And there's a lot of literature on that. If you're interested, you can find lots of books. On the Beach by Neville Shute is a fantastic book about the devastating impact of nuclear war. That's, I think, a good place to start thinking about it. But the possibility that life on Earth is gone. Now, because of that devastation, because of the just severity of that threat, the ultimate threat, underneath everything that was going on in the Cold War, all the political and military action, was the possibility of nuclear war. So that shadow hung over everything. As I mentioned before, the reason you didn't want regional conflict to escalate was because you didn't want World War III, because World War III could be the end of everything. If you're interested, you can look at this report, the link on the bottom of slide 24. It's an Office of Technology assessment report on the effects of nuclear war, done back in 1979, during the Cold War. And it looked at the possibility of nuclear strikes. And one of the estimates was that if you had a 1 megaton blast, and we'll talk about what that means, but it's a nuclear detonation, and the power of that was measured as a megaton. And I'll mention this again later, but what that meant is that this one particular bomb had the equivalent explosive power of 1 million tons of conventional explosive. The United States and Soviet Union had hundreds, thousands of bombs of that size. So just imagine one detonated over St. Louis, for instance, in this scenario, with typical winds blowing eastward. A 1 megaton blast over St. Louis would kill 25% of the population of Richmond. That's what we're talking about here. Now imagine thousands of these being dropped. Well, that's what we're talking about when we talk about nuclear war. This is significantly different. We are in a different age. Everything is changed. Now, let's talk about that in a little bit more detail to understand the technology and understand the weapons, and then we'll get to deterrence, and deterrence is the policy. So first, atomic and nuclear weapons. And I included, you'll see slide 25, a little bit of a warning slide, just in case we're going to talk about this, and it can be a bit gruesome discussion. And some of the images I'm going to show you may be a bit gruesome to some people. I don't include any slides of injuries to people because I think that's too much, but there are pictures of devastation of cities. And some people have suggested that devastation is damaging enough and horrific enough that I should say, okay, what follows is going to be pretty horrific. But certainly not as bad as it could be. This is actually kind of mild in terms of the possible devastation. So let's talk about the age. Well, during World War II, we're going to go back for a second to slide 24. During World War II, the United States, Germany, and Japan are all working to develop atomic weaponry. And what atomic weapons are in terms of technology, it's actually splitting an atom. You take isotopes of uranium and you actually fire neutrons into the nucleus of that isotope of uranium, and the idea is to break apart the nucleus, and that releases protons and neutrons and massive amounts of energy. So this is extremely difficult to do. It's one of the most significant engineering achievements in the history of the planet, and all three countries are working on it. And the thinking is that whoever develops this capability to split an atom, to split open a nucleus and release all that energy in a devastating explosion, which can destroy an entire city, one bomb to destroy an entire city, whoever does that wins World War II. That's the assumption. Well, Japan didn't get very far. So ultimately, the race was between Germany and the United States. The U.S. project was called the Manhattan Project. It was based in New Mexico, in Los Alamos, New Mexico. You can go to a museum there today, and you can see some of the scientific research and some of the historical artifacts of the development. Well, the United States and Germany are both racing toward this. Actually, as it turns out, Germany surrenders. Germany's defeated before either country develops atomic weaponry. Well, the United States detonates its first atomic bomb, July 16, 1945. The United States is still at war with Japan. So the United States decides, all right, we're going to drop this bomb on Japan. Now, here's a bomb that's going to destroy an entire city. And people question the morality. People talk about that, the morality of dropping a bomb like that. But morality actually wasn't the issue at the time, because all the nations of World War II had already crossed that moral boundary. If you think about the division between civilians and combatants, right? People with guns versus people who are just in their houses living their lives. Well, that boundary between civilians and combatants had already disappeared during World War II. Both the United States and Germany and all the other major powers who were fighting at the time had already decided that in order to win the war, we will destroy entire cities. We will kill thousands of civilians. So, for instance, the United States, in dropping bombs on Germany, actually was bombing and bombing so severely and so intensively in, for instance, Hamburg or Dresden, different cities in Germany, that the whole point of the bombing was to actually catch the cities on fire completely. And that was done. It was accomplished. So, for instance, right after Germany surrendered in May of 1945, over a weekend, the United States bombed Tokyo. Bombed Tokyo again so intensively that about 100,000 people were killed in the weekend. So, from a moral perspective, everyone had already crossed that moral line. So, nuclear weapons, the ability to kill 70, 80,000, 90,000 people with one bomb was actually at that time just a matter of efficiency. We already had decided we were willing to kill 70,000 people. But instead of taking bombing run after bombing run and the dropping of tonnage of bombs and hundreds of bombs, instead you could do it with one bomb. So that's a gruesome fact, but it's a matter of efficiency. Well, the United States detonated its first, July 16th, 1945, and then said, well, we're still fighting with Japan, so we are going to drop them on Japan. And the first bomb was dropped on Hiroshima, August 6th, 1945, the beginning of the atomic age. On slide 26, you can see the Hiroshima bomb. Now, Hiroshima bomb, the estimates of how many people were killed range between 70 and 80,000 people. Instantly killed. And then another 50 to 70,000 people killed over the next few weeks because of the fallout from the bomb, radiation. The thing about a conventional bomb is there's the devastation of the bomb, and then people die from the blast effects. But that's it. With an atomic weapon or a nuclear weapon, and we'll talk about the difference in just a second, with an atomic weapon or a nuclear weapon, what you get is radiation that's released. And that radiation kills people from radiation poisoning. Over the next 2-3 weeks, over the next few months, that radiation actually gets into your cells and breaks the cells down, and you die a very slow, painful, gruesome death. But also, even if you survive, that radiation is in you. And people who survive the Hiroshima blast have higher rates of cancer. The children of the people who survived the Hiroshima blast have higher rates of cancer and birth defects. The grandchildren of the people who survived the Hiroshima blast have greater cancer rates and greater rates of birth defects. The great-grandchildren, etc., etc., etc. That radiation has deeply affected individuals who survived, even their ancestors, their descendants. Not their ancestors, their descendants were also affected deeply by that. The radiation doesn't go away. It lingers on for decades in your system and in your family biologically. So that's how devastating these are. The initial blast and blasts themselves can go miles up into the sky, and you get this massive fireball, and you can see the mushroom cloud, the classic mushroom cloud formation. The reason you get that mushroom cloud is because the blast itself is starting to rise up, and then it starts to hit parts of the upper atmosphere, which contain it a little bit, so it starts to spread out. Well, the devastation, again, people estimate even as high as 120,000 to 140,000 people ultimately killed from the bomb. If you slide over to slide 27, you can see Hiroshima after. Now imagine an urban area, like parts of downtown Richmond. That's what's left over afterwards. You can see the streets, but everything else has been completely wiped out, simply burned to the ground. And this is one bomb that did it. Slide 28 gives you another picture of that devastation. That's the Peace Dome. And just recently, President Obama was there. They've rebuilt it. It's a museum now. But that structure survived, partially, and they rebuilt it. But that's the downtown area of Hiroshima. I mean, that's the utter devastation. Now, why drop the bomb on Hiroshima? Well, the United States was negotiating with Japan at the time for Japanese surrender. And Japan essentially was saying, well, we'd like to negotiate. And U.S. policy on war termination or ending any kind of war had been no negotiation. That's not the way the United States does things. Because the United States had learned, and this goes back to the Civil War and even before that, that if you start negotiation with your opponent says, well, we'll surrender if you give us this. And you say, okay, we'll give you that. And then they say, okay, well, you know, now we also want this other thing. And so you may say, okay, you can have that too. And they say, okay, well, you know, we also want this third thing. So the United States policy was, we don't negotiate. We hurt you. We fight you until you say, I surrender, period. Not, I surrender, but I'd like this, that, or the other thing. It's, I surrender, period. And at this particular point, the United States and Japan are negotiating, and Japan is saying, we will surrender, but we want to make sure you do not put the emperor on trial for war crimes. The emperor was the leader of Japan at the time. The emperor in Japanese mythology and in basic Japanese belief at the time is that the emperor is semi-divine. The emperor is the descendant of the sun goddess. So the idea that we'll continue to fight to spare the emperor, that made sense in Japanese culture and Japanese politics at the time. The United States' attitude was, you surrender, period. So Japan said, we'll surrender, but we want guarantees you won't put the emperor on trial for war crimes. The United States said no and dropped the Hiroshima bomb. Then the United States said to Japan, well, will you surrender? And Japan said, we'll surrender, but we want a promise that you won't put the emperor on trial for war crimes. And the United States' response to that was the next slide. Number 29, dropping an atomic bomb on Nagasaki on August 9th, 1945. And here you have a before and after picture of Nagasaki. You can see the city in the upper part of the slide, and then you can see nothing in the bottom part of the slide. That's how devastating this was. Another 80 to 150,000, 80 instantly, and then ultimately about 150,000 people killed. One of the reasons that there are estimates about this number is because no one's quite sure how many people were in the city at the time. But we're talking about a high estimate of about 150,000 people, maybe a low estimate of 120,000 people ultimately, but about 80,000 people killed very, very quickly. Well, Japan ultimately surrenders very quickly after that, actually on August 15th. The United States had dropped two atomic bombs on Japan, and actually at the time, the United States had the first bomb, which it was its test in July, and the second and third bombs the United States had at the time, they dropped on Hiroshima and Nagasaki, and the thinking was at the time that the United States might have to drop 9 bombs on Japan. And the idea was, well, how do we defeat them? We can launch this massive invasion, and the estimates were that that invasion would include several million Americans and possibly hundreds of thousands of more casualties, maybe double the number of casualties that were killed in World War II, and the war might continue on to 1952, were some estimates of this. But they didn't even really spend a whole lot of time thinking about it. The idea was, we have these bombs, we have these weapons, we're fighting a war, we use them. That's how simple that decision was at the time. Again, the moral line had already been crossed. Well, August 9th, the Nagasaki bomb. August 15th, Japan surrenders. And that's the end of World War II. Well, the big aspect of atomic weapons, let's turn to slide 30, and there you've got that classic mushroom cloud picture. The big aspect of this is that this is a revolution in technology and efficiency. Nothing like this had ever been accomplished. No weapon like this had ever been developed. People looked at this and said, this is a doomsday weapon. You can destroy an entire city in one bomb. And if you have dozens of these, hundreds of these, thousands of these, you have the ability to destroy an entire nation. I mean, completely destroy it. So it ceases to exist. And then the potential to destroy all civilization. That's why people are worried about it. And again, the lingering effects of the radiation, well, that spreads around the world. It gets into the atmosphere. So the idea is that you may drop several hundred bombs on a nation. You may kill outright 50% of the population. And then 25% of the population dies slowly over the next 6 months. Another 15% of the population is completely sterile because of the radiation. And what survives, who survives left over, is deeply damaged, has no immune system. For instance, the radiation destroys your immune system. And basically, the human race is slowly dying. And that's the end of the planet. Well, that's the kind of devastation that people are capable of at the time. Now, let's talk about the weapons themselves. Now, as I mentioned, an atomic weapon is a weapon where you're actually splitting an atom. Now, I look on the slide and I see atomic and nuclear weapons. Now, an atomic weapon is a first generation weapon. Again, you're splitting an atom. A nuclear weapon is a little bit different. That's a second generation weapon. The United States detonated its first atomic bomb in 1945. The Soviet Union detonated its first atomic bomb in 1949. The United States then detonated its first nuclear bomb in 1952. The Soviets detonated their first nuclear bomb in 1953. Now, when you talk to physicists or people who study these weapons, who have the technological background, I'm a political scientist, so I can tell you what I know, but I'm not a physicist. They will tell you that the difference between a conventional weapon and an atomic weapon is smaller than the difference between an atomic weapon and a nuclear weapon. Think about that. So, an atomic weapon, you're splitting an atom. In a nuclear weapon, you're actually taking atoms of hydrogen and you're fusing them together to create helium, and that also releases massive amounts of energy. Now, what converts hydrogen to helium as part of its normal process? You may know this, but that's what the sun does. So in the early 1950s, the United States and the Soviet Union both developed the capability for nuclear weapons that had the technology to essentially replicate what the sun does and release massive amounts of energy. So that's where we are. And to do that in something the size of, your average desk in someone's office in a political science department. Now, to give you an idea of the power we're talking about there, nuclear weapons are often called hydrogen bombs as well, are often called thermonuclear weapons, and thermo meaning temperature. And the point there is, in order to get hydrogen fused together to be helium, you need massive amounts of heat. Well, how do you get that heat? In the early nuclear weapons, you detonated an atomic bomb inside the weapon. Think about that. An atomic bomb went from the most devastating military weapon in history to the trigger for a nuclear bomb. That's the kind of power we're talking about. Now, to give you another illustration of that and this power, what kind of explosive power do you get? Well, the Hiroshima bomb is often measured as 20 kilotons in power. Now, what that means is 20,000 tons, the equivalent of 20,000 tons of conventional explosive. That's the blast effect that you get from an atomic weapon. That's with the blast of a Hiroshima bomb. So imagine 20,000 tons of explosive. And again, not 20,000 pounds, but 20,000 tons, and a ton is 2,000 pounds. So instead of dropping 20,000 tons of conventional explosive, you drop one bomb. That's the capability of the Hiroshima bomb. Now, for nuclear weapons, they stopped measuring those in kilotons, or thousands of tons, and they measured those in megatons, millions of tons, the equivalent of several million tons of conventional explosive. And the United States and the Soviet Union regularly deployed 1 megaton bombs, or warheads. That's what a bomb on a missile would be called. We'll get to some of the terminology in a little bit. But the idea is a bomb that had the capability, the equivalency of 1 million tons of conventional explosive power. Those were regularly deployed. 2 megaton bombs, 10 megaton bombs. The Soviets actually detonated a 50 megaton bomb once on an island that no longer exists. They vaporized it completely. Now, to give you a little bit more of an idea, the Soviets actually deployed a missile at one point called the SS-18. That was the designation of this missile. On each missile, and you don't need to know the details of this, but this tells you what the United States and the Soviet Union were capable of, The Soviets deployed an SS-18. Each SS-18 had 10 warheads, 10 bombs on it. Each bomb had 750 kilotons of explosive power. So each missile had 7.5 megatons of explosive power on it. The one single missile, 7.5 megatons of explosive power. The Soviets had 308 of those. Now you can calculate 308 times 7.5 to get the megatonnage in just the SS-18 missile. And of course the Soviets had a lot of other missiles. That was just one of their missile deployments. Give you an idea of what the United States had. The United States Trident submarine, each United States Trident submarine had 91.2 megatons of explosive power on it. At the height of the Cold War, the United States was deploying 18 of those submarines, 91.2 megatons on each one. So from the 1950s to the 1980s, the United States and the Soviet Union had thousands. Ultimate numbers reached over 50,000 nuclear weapons between the two countries. And again, that's when you start to say, my God, they can destroy the entire world. And the answer is yes, probably. Well, that sounds insane. Why do that? Why develop all those weapons? Well, let's hold off on that question for just a second. That's the obvious question people are going to ask. I want to talk a little bit more about the deployments, and then we'll answer that question a little bit more. Well, both the United States and the Soviet Union by the early 1950s had all this capability. So how do they actually deploy this capability? We'll talk about how they actually deployed it, how they actually put it into use, and then we'll talk about the policy for it. Well, by the late 1950s, the United States and the Soviet Union both had developed what they called a triad, meaning that there were three ways to deploy nuclear weapons. Well, slide 31, that's the first way. Strategic bombers. Now, this is the old traditional way. The United States had used bombers to drop bombs, conventional explosives. Well, now that you have nuclear weapons, what you can do is just put nuclear bombs on the strategic bombers, bombers that can take off in the United States and fly across the planet to drop their bombs. So nothing super sophisticated. Those bombers themselves, or I should say those bombs themselves, when they were dropped through the high technology of gravity. Well, that's the first leg of the triad, right? Three ways to develop nuclear weapons. The first one was strategic bombers. And during the 1950s, both the United States and the Soviet Union, their capabilities were based on bomber technology. But both countries were working on missile capability. And that gets us to the second leg of the triad. Slide 32, an intercontinental ballistic missile. And these are a couple pictures of ballistic missiles there. Now, what's important about this is that bombers take hours to get to their target. Bombers are relatively slow. Even the fastest bombers are seen as slow because they're so big, and you can shoot them down. Now you get an ICBM. An ICBM that you can deploy in the United States somewhere, and you can fire it off, and within 30 minutes, it can hit its target in the Soviet Union. It's very fast, so it reduces the amount of time you have to prepare. It also cannot be shot down. It's only now in the 21st century, in the early part of the 21st century, that the United States is developing the technology to actually shoot down incoming warheads that are based on an ICBM. And we're not very good at it yet. So you get to the 1950s, 1960s, 1970s, no one has the capability to shoot these things down. You fire them off, they hit their target. Not only that, but once you fire them off, you can't recall them. If a bomber takes off on its way to its target, it may take several hours to get there, and the political military crisis may disappear at the time, and you send a message to the bomber that says, come home. Well, you can't send a message to an ICBM to say, come home. Once you launch it, it cannot be recalled. And the reason for that is you don't want to develop the kind of technology where you could send a radio signal essentially to a computer that's in a missile and say, come home, or abort mission, because somebody else could also do it. With a human element, you can have all kinds of checks into it to make sure we've got code, and you relay the code to the pilot, and the pilot says, yes, the code is authentic, then I will not fire, I will not drop my bombs, I will return home. Can't do that with a missile. So missiles are fired, they will hit their target, you can't shoot them down, you've got 30 minutes until things start blowing up. So an ICBM is much more of a threat in that sense, gives you greater capability. Very quickly, if you slip to the next slide, you'll see a trajectory of an ICBM. Well, the reason to put it up there is to explain a couple things about ICBMs. First of all, actually, don't worry about the slide so much right now. But here you've got a missile. Now on this missile, when you put a bomb on a missile, it's called a warhead. It looks sort of like an upside down ice cream cone. And you can put one warhead on your missile, or you can put three, or you can put 10, or you can put 20. As the United States and the Soviet Union became adept at miniaturization, the actual warheads got smaller, so you could put more and more on your missile. Those warheads were called multiple independently targeted reentry vehicles, or MIRVs, and we'll talk about that a little bit later. Don't worry about that too much detail. Nobody needs to know about MIRVs. We can talk about those a little bit later. What would happen is, now the diagram on slide 33 is relevant. If you look at the right side, you'll see a missile being fired. And what will happen is the missile itself, if you've ever seen pictures of Apollo missions, the first stage and the second stage would fall off, and you'd wind up at the third stage. The third stage would actually be what was called a MIRV bus. And what it is a platform that has the warheads on it. And the platform itself has propulsion. And it zips through space. These are called ballistic because they go into space. You actually can see on the left side of the screen, in that picture, you'll see a space shuttle orbit, which is that little dotted line on the left. Now take a look at where the ICBM is going. Deep into space. So it's in space, it's on this, all these warheads are on the bus, and they're floating through space on their way to the target, and the bus itself has propulsion. And what it does, it starts to drop its warheads at various points, so that the warheads hit various targets. Six warheads can hit six different targets. So you can imagine one missile, if it had three warheads on it, fired from the Soviet Union, could go and say, well, we're going to hit Richmond, we're going to hit Petersburg, we're going to hit Norfolk. All three with one missile. And it's three warheads that are there. Now, the deployment of the ICBMs are actually deployed underground in what are called silos. They kind of look like an upside-down grain silo. So the missile itself is underground, and the lid of this silo is a concrete door that slides open when you want to fire the missile. The point of having them underground is to make them less vulnerable. So the idea is you've got this missile in its underground housing in this silo, and your opponent could launch an attack on your ICBM, and it would hit the ground near the silo, or it would hit the top of the door, and there could be explosion after explosion after explosion, warhead after warhead after warhead would hit it. And yet, underground, the missile is fine. The silo itself is actually built into a larger hollow area, so that the entire structure, the silo, and a launch control center that has the people firing the missiles in it, all underground, the whole thing can sway and move and bob when explosions are hitting the earth around it. So the people, the Air Force officers, ICBMs were part of the Air Force officers under the ground in the launch control centers. They have their own air supply, their own food supply, so they can live under there for a while in case a nuclear war might take weeks. And they sit there and wait to be told to launch their missile. So billions of dollars, trillions of dollars, and incredible technological achievements to fire these off, to have these things deployed underground. And when you need them, there are people who survive a nuclear strike inside that launch control center who have the ability to then launch a missile, you know, open up that concrete door and launch their missiles at a target. Now, why you do that, we'll talk about that in just a second. Again, that gets to the question of why you have all of this. Because so far we've got strategic bombers, we've got ICBMs, but why build both? Keep that question in mind. Let's move to the third leg of the triad. Third leg of the triad, submarine-launched ballistic missiles. Now, this is where you took missiles themselves and you put them in submarines. And the idea here is that you have these missiles in a submarine and they're somewhere in the ocean and nobody knows where they are. The bombers are easy to detect. ICBMs, well, when you start building those silos, you start building the way you deploy them, well, satellite technology can pick those up. So you can figure out where the ICBMs are, you can figure out where the bombers are, but the subs, well, the subs are launched from where they're built, and on the day there's a big parade and there's a big ceremony, and then the submarine goes under the water, and then no one knows where it is anymore. That adds an element of surprise to all this. And the picture that you see is actually a missile coming out from a sub. And if you go online and look at some videos of this, they're pretty amazing, because these missiles themselves are ejected from the sub with compressed air. So they actually pop up out of the water, and then the engine fires. You don't want the engine to fire underwater, because that destroys the submarine, or hurts part of the submarine. So slide to slide 35. This is the USS Alabama, an Ohio-class strategic missile submarine, and those are the launch tubes opened while it's in dock. That's 24 missiles, which can be deployed with 14 warheads each. They weren't always deployed that way, but they have the ability, each missile, to have 14 warheads. 24 missiles. So what you've got is a submarine somewhere on the planet, somewhere under the ocean, ready to hit the Soviet Union at any particular time. The Soviets also developed this as well. Soviets had their own version of the triad. So the United States had strategic bombers, ICBMs, and SLBMs out there to the tune of tens of thousands of warheads. I think there was one more picture. Actually, let me back up for a second. That slide 35 with the launch tubes. I got this from a student and he gave it to me and I said, am I allowed to have this picture? And he said, I don't know. This may be classified. Anyway, no one's ever complained about it and I've never been arrested. And it's a really cool picture. So gives you a good idea. Slide 36 is artwork of a sub. That's an older model. I think that's a Polaris submarine, an older model of the sub launching its missile. Well, why do this? Why develop all these weapons? Because both sides had tens of thousands of weapons. And the idea was to create a threat. So why do you create a threat? Hold that thought for a second. Because let's talk about a concept first. And this is moving on. Let's see, slide 37 are just some links. If you're interested in more about nuclear weapons, you can click on all these and read a little bit about it, and you'll get some more information on nuclear weapons. But we want to get to slide 38. The point of all these weapons, the reason why you developed a triad, the reason why you had bombers and ICBMs and SLBMs and all these different ways and tens of thousands of weapons, the reason was deterrence. Now, let's talk about the concept of deterrence. you all actually understand deterrence. You know a lot about it. You're very familiar with the concept. But putting it in sort of political science terms, you're in a situation. You have an opponent. And your goal is to convince your enemy not to do something. Convincing your enemy not to take an action. Your enemy has not done anything. Your opponent has not done anything. But you think they might. So you want to make sure they don't. So you're preventing action. How do you prevent action? You prevent action with a threat. You issue a threat. You say, if you do X, we will do Y in retaliation. So don't do X. It's a message. If you look on the slide, it says influencing the enemy's decision-making process. That's what you're doing. You imagine your enemy or your opponent is thinking about doing something. Should I do this? And they're calculating, well, do I do this or do I not do this? And you send a message to them that says, if you do it, if you take that action, horrible, terrible things will happen to you. And you hope that it influences the enemy's decision-making process. So the enemy says, if I do X, Y will happen to me. Horrible things will happen to me. So I won't do it. I decide not to do it. You don't want to have to carry out that threat. That's really important. You never want to have to carry out the threat. If you have to carry out the threat, deterrence has failed. So the point is to issue a threat and hope that the enemy will not take the action. Now, that's a basic concept. We'll get to credibility in a second, but that's a basic concept. Your parents use deterrence. I'm a parent. I use deterrence all the time. Right? A parent says to a child, okay, you're thinking of staying out past midnight. I told you don't stay out past midnight. You're thinking of staying out past midnight, and you probably have that problem. It's the summer, for instance. You've been away at school. You come home, and your parents expect you to go back to your curfew that you had in high school, or your lifestyle that you had in high school. And your attitude is, I've been in college. I used to stay out really, really late. Mom, Dad, I'm not going to come home by 11 o'clock every night. And they say, come home by 11 o'clock. If you stay out later than 11 o'clock, you will be punished. And that's the threat. It's a threat of punishment or retaliation. So in the case of don't stay out past 11, the threat is you'll be grounded. You'll lose the car for a week. No spending money over the summer. Something, there's a threat. And so when you're out with your friends and it's 10:45 and you're thinking, oh, do I stay out with my friends or do I go home? What happens to me if I stay out too late? I get grounded. I better go home. Deterrence is successful. Or the picture there, I'll get to the picture in a second. Let's get right to the Cold War. The United States said to the Soviet Union, if you invade West Germany, we will launch a nuclear strike against Moscow, St. Petersburg, other parts of the Soviet Union. We will launch a nuclear strike. That was the threat. That was the nuclear threat. If you attack West Germany, even with conventional weapons, the United States said, we will launch a nuclear strike against you. And we're trying to influence the enemy's decision-making process. We imagine the General Secretary of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, that's the leader of the Soviet Union, we imagine him waking up one morning and saying, that's it, I'm going to end the Cold War, I'm going to invade West Germany, conquer France, destroy the United Kingdom, we're going to destroy NATO, we're going to win World War III. I'm going to do it today. Now, military advisors, what can possibly happen if we launch this strike? Well, Comrade General Secretary, the United States says that it will launch a nuclear strike and vaporize Moscow. and all the other major cities of the Soviet Union if you invade West Germany. Okay, the enemy has to make a decision. What does the General Secretary of the Communist Party think? All right, so if they launch a nuclear strike, what happens? Well, we all die. It's the end of the Soviet Union. And the General Secretary says, okay, well, I will simply have to learn to live with West Germany for a while longer. That was the goal. You influence the enemy so the enemy does not take an action. You threaten. And the United States made it very, very clear. If you start a war in Europe, the United States will make that a nuclear war. It will become World War III. So do not start the war. That was nuclear deterrence. Actually, that specific aspect of it was called extended deterrence. Nuclear deterrence, just in general, is the idea that if the Soviet Union launches a nuclear strike against the United States will launch a nuclear strike in return. So the threat is, do not launch a strike against the United States, or the United States will punish you by retaliating with nuclear weapons. And that's the end of the war. We both get hurt badly. In the case of Europe, it was called an extended deterrent because the United States was saying also, if you attack not only the United States, but if you attack Europe as well, or if you attack Japan, the United States will use nuclear weapons to retaliate against you, so do not take the action. Now, it seems like that worked. You never really know if deterrence is successful. Now, did the Soviets ever say, today we start the war, but oh yeah, nuclear weapons, maybe we shouldn't do it? We're not sure. We're not sure about that. You know when deterrence has failed, because you say, do not take this action, and they take the action. Right? Do not come home past 11 o'clock, but you come home past 11 o'clock. Deterrence has failed. Do not launch a conventional strike into West Germany, and if the Soviets had, well, we knew that deterrence had failed. So deterrence is a psychological process. Now, where does credibility come in? Well, that's part of the psychological process. That gets back to the question of why bombers and ICBMs and SLBMs and why tens of thousands of them? The reason for that is credibility. You've issued a threat. Is it believable? That's a really important point. You have to issue a believable threat. Is it credible? Now, imagine sort of a simple idea. You put a beware of dog sign in your yard, in your front yard. The point is, you are going to deter a robber, right? Beware of dog is a threat, right? If I rob this house, I will get attacked by a dog. I have been threatened by a dog, so therefore I don't rob this house. I go next door. But, all right, I'm afraid of dogs. But you need a big dog. You need a big threat, a credible, believable, scary threat. So that's what the picture is about, credibility. Which one of these dogs is a credible threat? Well, the dog on the right looks pretty scary and dangerous. That's a pretty credible threat. Lots of big teeth, looks angry. The dog on the left, not a very credible threat. If I have beware of dog, and that's the picture you see of the dog, you say, I'm going to rob this house. I might take that dog too because it's so cute. Actually, that's my dog. That's Franny. She's our puppy. Oh, she's a bad dog. But besides that, she's not bad enough to be really much of a deterrent. But you want a credible threat. Now, what does that have to do with nuclear weapons? Well, a triad is that dog on the right. That's the point. You're saying to the Soviets, if you attack West Germany, start a war in Europe, or if you launch a strike against the United States, a nuclear strike against the United States, we have thousands of weapons, and we have three ways to retaliate against you. And we're going to test them. We're going to detonate atomic bombs and nuclear bombs and say, hey, look, we can still do it. We're going to launch ICBMs and say, look, Look at our missile capability. We're going to show the Soviets the submarines and say, look at this submarine. Look at all the missiles that this submarine has. Now you see it, now you don't. And the idea is to make that threat so credible and believable. Look at all the things that we can do. And we can do them over and over and over again. And every year we do them better. So be afraid. If you attack us, we can strike against you. We have the capability to do it. And you know that. So now we've got a credible and believable deterrent. But there's actually more. All right, here's the more. Turn to slide 39. Well, the United States and the Soviet Union both developed their triad, as I mentioned. Bombers, SLBMs, ICBMs. Well, here's another reason why. All right, and you'll see the slide. Why so many weapons? Deterrence, again. Let's say the United States didn't have that many nuclear weapons. And let's say the United States only had bombers, right? Bombers on a dozen bases in the United States. So the Soviets launch a first strike, and that's the specific term used for going first. So you hear that term used if you read about nuclear weapons, a first strike. And you can see the arrow there is a very large arrow. So the Soviets launch a first strike. They destroy 80% of all the bombers, and the United States then sends its other bombers, its leftover bombers, out to destroy the Soviet Union, and the Soviets can shoot down 50% of those bombers. So ultimately, when the nuclear war is over, the Soviets have detonated, let's say, 1,000 bombs on United States soil, and the United States has detonated 5 on Soviet soil. Well, the Soviet Union just won a nuclear war because the Soviets launched a first strike, and that second strike that you see, that small arrow coming from the United States, it's small, it's uncoordinated, maybe it doesn't even hit the right targets, maybe it doesn't hit actually any ICBM fields. It might go ahead and bomb silos in the Soviet Union in which the missiles have already been fired. Because it's uncoordinated, the United States is under massive attack, the communications aren't very good. Well, the Soviets look at this and say, we can come up with a scenario where we win a nuclear war. Because the United States only has a couple hundred nuclear bombers and nothing else. Doesn't have any ICBMs, doesn't have any SLBMs. We can destroy most of those bombers. So we go first, we win. Going first really matters. In this case, if you go second, you lose. You could flip this around, and the United States might say, if we launch our strike against the Soviets, and the Soviets only have bombers, well, we launch a strike against the Soviets. They're devastated, and when they launch their second strike, it's a small second strike, doesn't hurt us very badly. We win the war. Now, what that means is, in a crisis, there's an incentive to going first. And that's a scary situation, is to be in a political military crisis somewhere in the world and for both sides to be thinking, I need to launch my weapons first. You don't want to go second, because if you go second, you lose. So both sides are thinking, we need to launch now. That's a scary scenario. You do not want that scenario. Well, that's why both sides had so many weapons. Because in this first diagram, there is no deterrence. There is no deterrence. If I go first, I win. What am I afraid of? What's the punishment or retaliation that I worry about? The General Secretary of the Communist Party says, what if we launch our weapons first? And his military advisors say, we win the war. Well, that's not necessarily much of a decision. Well, then do it. Launch, destroy the United States. That's why you have so many weapons. Look at slide 40. Here's a situation with the triad. In this situation, let's say the Soviets launch a first strike. Well, let's say they destroy 80% of U.S. bombers. But United States ICBMs are inside their silos. They're not very, very vulnerable. The Soviets only destroy 25% of U.S. ICBMs. So 75% of U.S. ICBMs, and we're talking about thousands of warheads, can still get to their target. Not only that, but the Soviets don't know where the submarines are. And maybe they are able to track down a couple of them. And while the United States and Soviet Union both had strategic missile submarines, both countries also had attack submarines, submarines whose job it was to just try to track the ballistic missile submarines. Read a book called Hunt for Red October by Tom Clancy, and that's about that anti-submarine warfare between U.S. strategic missile submarines and Soviet strategic missile submarines and all the attack sides on either sides looking for them. It's a great book, but it also gives you a good idea of the Cold War below sea level. So the Soviets, maybe they can find 10% of our subs, but 90% of them will still be out there. So if the Soviets launch a first strike, still most of our ICBMs will hit their targets. Almost all of our submarines will hit their targets. So can the Soviets win? No, not in that scenario. They can't win. And even if they develop some technological developments, let's say they found a way to destroy all of the bombers and all of the ICBMs, the SLBMs will still be enough all by themselves to be a strong deterrent. And that was the point. Each leg needed to function independently as a deterrent, a big enough punishment, a big enough threat of retaliation, so that the General Secretary of the Soviet Union would say, come up with a scenario for how we win a nuclear war. And the military advisor says, well, we can get most of their bombers, but not all of their ICBMs and SLBMs. So what if we destroy all their bombers? Well, we still die. What if we destroy all their ICBMs and bombers? Well, then the SLBMs kill us. So is there any way to destroy all three legs of the triad? No. We can, even if we destroy 50%, excuse me, 100% of two of the three legs and 50% of the third leg, 50% of the third leg is still enough to destroy the Soviet Union completely. So the General Secretary says, so what can you give me? What do I get if I launch a nuclear strike? If I go first, and there's an advantage in going first, what do I get? And the answer is, you live 15 minutes longer than the United States lives. The idea there is that never, ever, ever will a leader of either country come up with an answer that says, we benefit from launching a nuclear strike. So in this case, you see on this PowerPoint slide, the Soviets launch a first strike and the U.S. second strike. No matter what the Soviets do, there still is a large U.S. second strike big enough to destroy the Soviet Union. And so no matter what scenario you come up with, because there are so many weapons, because the weapons are deployed in three different ways, and actually they started to develop fourth different ways as well, a little bit, and fifth different ways, lots of different ways, but those are the three main ways early on. But because of so many weapons and so many deployment modes, there was no way you could come up with a scenario for victory. No matter what you did, everybody died. This actually was referred to as assured destruction, or sometimes people called it mutually assured destruction, or MAD. But that was the scenario. Second strike capability is what creates deterrence. Now, we can talk about this, ask some more questions about this when we all get back, or please send me emails about this, because this is the stuff that I studied in my PhD, my main field of study. There are some people who argue that deterrence, that's one aspect of it. There are some people who criticize this and say that the reason you had tens of thousands of nuclear weapons was to keep the defense industry afloat. It's a criticism of the what people sometimes call the military-industrial complex. And the point was, is a constant flow of dollars into the United States military infrastructure. That's why you had tens of thousands And that the triad idea and the second strike capability idea is interesting, but that's not the real motivation. So there are lots of different ways of looking at it, but the logic of nuclear weapons suggests that the only way to prevent nuclear war is to make it as devastating as possible, because you never, ever, ever, ever want anybody to say, I think I can win a nuclear war. And that creates stability within deterrence. Now, last thing we'll talk about before I end this part of the lecture is slide 41. If you remember, number 6 here was deterrence and forward presence. And forward presence is something the United States started to develop after World War II in a big way. It had done that previous to World War II in a smaller way. But since World War II, the United States has maintained a policy of forward presence, and it's still the United States policy today. The point is, the United States military forces need to be everywhere. Not just deployed in the United States, waiting to go somewhere in case there's trouble, but the United States should be there. Military forces should be deployed around the world. And this map, you can pick any year you want, but this is just from 2007. And you look at this, the light blue says more than 1,000 U.S. troops in different areas of the world. And you can see, obviously, in the United States, but you look at all throughout Europe and different parts of the Middle East and parts of South Asia and also East Asia as well. You can look at the darker blue parts, and that's more than 100 U.S. troops, which means the United States has small deployments there, probably liaison or training offices there, and also other parts around the world. The purple part, and imagine, if you want for a second, everything colored in there, imagine that it's all purple of any color. That's the use of military facilities, which means the United States military can be there if it needs to be. And in some ways, that reflects the Air Force and the Navy, in which they may not be there at that particular moment. They may be in the air or on the sea, but they have the ability to arrive in a country within a day or so and engage in military hostilities any place they need to. So the point is, the United States should be there. We're deployed. We are there. We are ready for action. It's also a deterrent. And during the Cold War, that was a key part of it. Saying to the Soviets, look, we are all over the place. We are everywhere. We surround you. We have military capabilities. If you had a map of this for the Soviet Union, what is the Soviet Union forward presence? Very little forward presence. Weaker Navy, much weaker compared to the United States Navy. The Soviets never had the kind of ability that the United States did and still does. Nobody in the world has that kind of capability that the United States does right now, in terms of forward presence, of being everywhere. So that was part of all of this as well, is that the United States was there, the United States was ready. Now, that's the end of the early Cold War lecture, and you're moving on to the intervention lecture from here.